Tonight, you'll hear a very distinguished panel in a lively and often heated discussion. The panel consists of Marshall McLuhan, the head of the Center for Culture and Technology at the University of Toronto, W.H. Auden, perhaps the most illustrious poet in English today, Buckminster Fuller, inventor, architect, and thinker, and Jack McGowran, Irish actor and foremost interpreter of the plays of Samuel Beckett. Ideas recorded them at the fourth annual seminar in Irish Studies held recently at the University of Toronto. The ostensible subject of their discussion is theatre and the visual arts. But as you'll hear in a moment, that topic is soon forgotten, as two modes of perception clash. That of Professor McLuhan, who is one of the most famous interpreters of contemporary 20th century cultural trends, and that of W.H. Auden, who cheerfully admits to being a 19th century man and sees no reason to change. Professor Norman Jeffers, a Yeats scholar and editor of Yeats Collected Works, who is chairman of the English department at Leeds University in England, is in the chair.
Perhaps we might begin by asking Mr. Auden, when he writes a play, whether he wonders what it will look like on the stage, and whether he has views about it, or whether they are realized by producers or not.
I have to begin by saying that I don't regard myself really as a playwright. I regard myself as a writer of opera libretti. Of course, they're both dramatic words. But when you are writing something, you have an idea of how you think it should look, but one isn't a professional, one hands it over to a stage designer, but knows it isn't right. My collaborator, Mr. Jess Gorman, and I did a libretto for Hans Werner Henze based on the Bacchae of Euripides. Well, we did have then a scenic idea, which is that the clothes that people are wearing can be a verbal shorthand for their character. So that we planned, and I'm glad to say our stage design agreed with us, that, for example, Pentheus looked like one of the sort of medieval Catholic monarchs. Tiresias was to look like an Anglican archdeacon. Cadmus was just looked like a fairy story old character, I mean, hundreds of years old. And when you really saw the meaning, of course, we changed it to from women only to double thing, then they had to look like beats. And it worked. That's all I could say. And that our stage designer knew this. I mentioned simply how one does visualize certain things when one's writing.
Mm. Marshall, would you like to comment on that in the light of your views of what happens today?
Mm. Well, the idea of putting on masks, power, energy, corporate masks, it's a very large subject, and clothing as language is one that I'm sure that we have an actor here who could tell us a good deal about, Mr. McGowran. I should like to hear Mr. McGowran's views on the interpretive powers of costume.
Yes, well, I'm in agreement to this degree, that costume as well as setting, design, direction, are all, in fact, part of a basic rule in that they are aids to an actor and no more, and as such should be simple and unobtrusive.
Yeah.
They should never try to say, look at this costume, look at my direction, look at my setting. All these things, including lighting, are all there to serve the purpose that is the actor and the spoken word. which are the most important things that the public have come to see and hear. You know, you've heard the phrase, they came away humming the sets. Well, this has been a fault of many of our scenic designers in that they are too prone to show their skill at designing a set which overwhelms the actor to such a degree that he is obscured, and the set is far too elaborate. I personally am involved in a theater and will always be involved in a theater where the emphasis is on simplicity.
I think we should, at that point, ask Mr. Buckminster Fuller how he is tackling this problem, because he is starting, as it were, from scratch to design a theatre in Oxford.
First place, I never have, never before, designed a theatre.
Mm.
And so it's really a very exciting venture for me. But I think at Oxford we were being interviewed by a newspaper about what the theatre was going to look like, how people would feel in it. And I said, if anybody even noticed my theatre, I think I'd be a failure. My determination really is to sublimate completely my structuring. And that I'd say, is the very essence. The Oxford Theatre is a very small one. Samuel Beckett had very strong ideas of what he wanted, and he wanted to have great versatility of presentation so that it will be able to do theatre at the proscenium, it'll have to be able to do the Greek, it'll have to be do the in the round, and be changeable from one to the other, again, without making people feel this. I don't have any feeling of mechanics at all.
Mm.
And furthermore, the Oxford Theatre has a very special requirement. It has to be underground.
Mm-hmm.
The city of Oxford and the university have decided that there, no building should be above the ground except the dormitories for the students to live in. They're so crowded today, so that we have to put it under the quadrangle of the column.
Does that also mean underwater?
And it also does mean underwater.
Yes. Yeah.
It'll be a submarine sublimation.
Well, now, I would like to ask Martin McLuhan, if I may, how he sees the theatre in our terms. Here is a theatre being built underground. I think he has views of the theatre as being something which also takes off a little bit from the ground.
We've just seen Apollo 14. Which has some visual effects going with it.
Mm.
It's a new type of theater, obviously. And there is another very observable form of theater, namely student activists, as they present themselves in new settings and new scripts, and as they call in the new media to assist their presentations. Since Sputnik, the planet has gone inside a man-made environment of satellites, and this makes everything on the planet simultaneously present to consciousness. They call it ecology, but when everything happens at once and everybody is involved, there is no audience. There are only actors. I think this is a new dimension of the electric theater. The role of the audience as actor, I think, is worth watching. And it might be possible to have comments from the panel on the varying degrees in which the audience has participated in the action in the past in theater. I suppose the mouse is the greatest form of theater possible, and is the one in which the audience is necessarily participant, in which there is no audience.
I must say, Mr. Kern, that I profoundly disapprove of artists, of audience participation. I think I know it's
Your audience is participating.
I know. No, I think the whole point when I go to the theatre is that I look. And I don't take part in the action, I observe. And this to me I know what goes on now. And I think it's an appalling lack of distinction in the public and the private life. Mm-hmm. People take off their clothes in public now on the stage. Well, that's the thing, one does privately, one doesn't want to think. It seems to be very, very important. I'm profoundly conservative on this point. That's why I'm in this terrible thing that happened, for example, with TV, is that it turns all historical fact into fiction. So that, people show films of people being blown up in Vietnam. People roar with laughter. It's all part of the film. And this frightens me very, very much indeed. I mean, it's not what the people intend, but I think I think TV is a very, very wicked medium. That's all I can say.
I'm interested in this because I have steadfastly reserved moral judgment on all media matters.
I do.
The telephone is a very wicked instrument, by all, of course, but not as bad as the motor car. These extremely inextricable and malignant forces in our midst, I am quite aware of. In fact, I have studied them very, very carefully. But I am also aware that one of the greatest dramas of our time is manhunting.
For sure.
Now, this is a hidden drama, but it does provide an enormous amount of entertainment in many media. In your own work, Mr. Auden, you have spent much time exploring the ways in which our new culture in this century destroyed the unconscious and pushed the unconscious up into the private psyche, destroying private identity.
I don't think so.
The destruction of... The simple process by which the unconscious was pushed up into consciousness with the help of electricity, Freud and Jung, is one of the big dramas of our time. And it's true, the private identity, the private individual, has been swept aside by this huge surge of the unconscious up into consciousness.
It's not how I feel about things. I know I'm rooted in the 19th century.
But are you expressing preferences or observations of fact?
Simply what I know about myself. I realize more and more as I get older how rooted I am in the 19th century. Thank God, I can remember the world before World War I. And thank God I was brought up to know that I was a member of the upper middle class profession. I'm terribly grateful for this.
Now, this is a circumstance that is very theatrical. It is part of your own mask that you use, the public school voice.
It's not my mask. It's what I am.
I mean, if some Canadian were to put on the public school voice, he would at once appear as an actor on a stage.
Well, I'm obviously I have an Oxford accent, though. Of course, the English say I have a mid-Atlantic accent, because I have shortened my A.
As an Englishman, I think you might have some very interesting things to say about language as mask, as an actor's mask.
It's not... Well, I think one of the things is when you're younger, you have to wear a mask. It's only the last few years I felt I could really speak in the first person. Genuinely, because I think, it takes a long time to find out who you are. Mm-hmm. And part of which, one of the things about coming to America, for example, is that I agree entirely with what someone said, Mom said, in order to understand your own country, You have to have lived in these two others.
Mr. Arden, will you please comment on the relation of the English language and prosody to jazz and rock?
I know nothing about them.
Well, you hear them. You can't. I don't. You can't help it.
I do. I don't have to hear them.
But
I live in an apartment in York, where I don't have to hear them.
Ah, not we. You know, York. You are now in the city of York. Toronto is York.
Yeah.
And there is the University of York nearby, so you better clarify. You mean York, England?
No, I mean in New York. I live and I don't have to hear it.
Well, you're very lucky. You can turn these things off.
I don't have them on.
But even in air travel, you can turn them off.
Well, that's just smart music. They have on, to try to quiet the nerves of people. I mean,
don't, before old Mozart and Bach.
They don't have rock music on.
Before old Mozart and Bach were the music of their day.
No.
Background music.
Oh, they were, the Divertimenti, for example, which obviously.
Or the Goldberg Variations were sleeping pills.
But I don't have to hear the rock because.
You can't miss it if you whether you try not. Now there is a very strange thing, Mr. Arden. There's a very strange thing. Rock can only be sung in English. No other language on earth can carry rock rhythms.
Because as far as popular songs are concerned, I think German is a much better language.
But it is not as able to carry rock rhythms.
No, I'm sure it isn't. But I like German lyrics like. It sits auf der Bahn, ich habe kein Geld.
And to our ears,
I sit at the bar and I have no money. This I appreciate.
I don't know if the audience has noticed, but more and more people are now ready to talk about their dreams. And this may well be a return to the kind of stability.
Oh, but my God, how boring one dreams are. Same the repetition. They're boring the same way the lunatics are. I happen to be thinking about this, so I have to give a Freud memorial lecture in March. But nothing seems to me less interesting about dreams. Nothing can be more inartistic than a dream, because they're actually formless. Or also repetitious. I've only once in my life had a dream that I thought was sufficiently interesting to write down. And it's not.
Would you venture to commit it to the oral tradition?
No.
I wonder, could we ask Mr. McGowan how he feels about audience participation? Does he feel this is an infringement on his trade union, or would he define the kind of participation he would like from an audience?
Well, I'd rather call it involvement rather than participation. And you know, theatre remains still the only three-dimensional medium we've got. Every other media is two-dimensional, and as such doesn't require an audience at all. But it's vastly different playing to a camera, whether it be television or a cinema or a radio to a microphone, and playing to a live audience from which there is a direct connect response and feeling and an indeterminate mystique which I can't explain. But I am very concerned about an audience's involvement with what is happening on the stage. An actor gets a very keen awareness after a number of years as to whether the audience are being involved in what he is doing or saying. And this involvement, I think, is particularly important to theatre. And without it, I don't think actors could have this extra dimension that the theatre needs.
You think rather well, don't you, about television as a means of education through the world. But do you think that we have too passive an audience in television, which can be acted on. I find, I don't know if other people share this today, that so many people don't actually listen to what you say. Years, I agree. But I think that you do find quite often in talking to someone that they have taken in about a third. And the rest of the time, no doubt, they've been watching the visual that you've presented to them. But their ears have got a little deaf in this curious way they're selected to.
Right. Talking about that, you know what happens with tape recorders? Because I know Truman Capote was being interviewed on the tape recorder. The tape recorder broke down. So he said, well, all right, you go on. Oh, but I'm not used to listening to what you say.
Mr. McGowan might be interested in the immediate prospect of 4- and 5-dimensional TV. That is, with the total image of the actor in the room, hologramic they call it. This is an immediate, it is now an engineering fact, and this can be a popular, available kind of experience at any time in any home. But whether this will change acting and the problems of the visual organization of theater is another question. I rather suspect that we are missing the game and not noticing how cinema has extended the bounds of theater globally, travelogue style. I don't think there's any part of the planet in which most people have not been, and undersea as well as above the sea. Many times, every child, by the time he gets to school, has been with Castro under the sea into the most amazing territories. And I'm not saying this is good or bad. It simply happens to all children today. There is no world of fantasy they have not visited, on television, Sesame Street, or animated cartoons and so on. The extensions of language into gesture of a massive and extensive type is happening. I personally am not prepared as a private individual to make value judgments about anything that is so massive. I really do think it does take a certain amount of 19th century egotism to confront this massive thing with a private point of view.
Well, I quite can't agree. Yeah. I do it. I mean, it is arrogant, but I am arrogant.
Well, good. And you think that would you inculcate this as an attitude in others?
Yes, I would.
Good. Let me ask Mr. McGowan, does he think the Greeks might have done with PA systems if they'd had them?
With?
PA systems such as we have here.
Oh, they would have resented them very much because they placed so much value on the power of the vocal power, their own vocal power, to reach an audience from any part of the auditorium that they would have scorned as opera singers today would scorn the use of microphones. And I think any actor, personally, who can produce vocally the effect necessary to fill a theater would be deadly against the use of microphones, which are apt to distort the voice in some way. I think if he has vocal equipment to be able to reach an audience without the use of PA, then it's all better.
Would they have shunned the gramophone and radio? Would they have turned them off? I'm perfectly prepared to say we ought to turn off radio and television today, now, and forever. I mean, I'm perfectly prepared to make that as a practical political suggestion.
Oh, I don't think we would miss it.
That's not practical. I wish it were.
I think for survival.
If I was a censor.
For survival, Mr.
Rogers,
let me suggest that not on moral grounds, but on survival grounds.
Well, there's not so much difference between them.
All right. I suggest that I'm glad to heartily concur with Mr. Austin, but I do suggest that on survival grounds, we might well consider the need to turn off TV for good. costs. The power of television to upgrade the Oriental and Negro image, for example, to the point where it crushes the white image, is so tremendous that it can only result in a bloodbath, because the white will not take it. I suggest, therefore, politically, if you want to save a fantastic bloodbath on this planet, which would be very dramatic and very cathartic and very tragic in the Greek sense, I suggest we turn off TV totally. For good.
Is it not too late?
Yeah. No.
I'm afraid for the masses it won't happen. But because
it'll happen.
The thing with TV is masked about it, well, it's game.
All I'm doing, Mr. Auden, all I'm doing, Mr. Auden, is one-upping your value judgment.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think your value judgments amount to a hoot, because you are a 19th century man.
Sure.
And I am aware. I am aware of 20th century actualities and.
Well, so am I. But I don't.
No, you are. I didn't say. I don't venture to approve or disapprove. I merely suggest that, if you see a fire, you quickly try to douse it. When I see TV or these electric forms dissolving every aspect of human individual, I say, turn it off. But who's going to turn it off? They prefer to burn down.
For sure.
Well, they prefer.
This won't happen, but it's not going to be.
I'm not saying it'll happen. We're doing it to ourselves. Nobody else is doing it to us.
Exactly.
All right. Then why won't it happen?
Because people like the damn thing.
The children in the fiery furnace. Do you think we can ape the children in the fiery furnace and enjoy the whole thing?
Well, I can, but obviously they do. TV is marvelous for games. You can see a tennis match or something better than
you are. You are missing the name of the game, sir. You are actually imagining that those little images you see on TV are TV. They are not. What is TV is that Feuerbach, fire stream pouring out of that tube into your gut.
Yeah.
Now, that is TV.
Yeah.
What you see on TV has nothing to do with TV. We're talking about the actual physical injection of those fire particles into your insides.
Well,
it's called an inner trip.
Well, of course, I don't have a TV, and I wouldn't dream of having one.
I know.
You
merely suffer the consequences of TV without enjoying it.
But I wouldn't enjoy it, I know, because the one thing, for example, occasionally in England or in Europe, I can look at TV, because, all right, I would like to see an old movie.
Mm. Very good.
But here, it's so
silent.
Cut. Exactly. Yeah, it's so cut with the commercial, you know, you can't enjoy it.
And have you not learned to enjoy our commercials as art form?
No, I know that. If you're a real TV buff, you think the commercials are the best thing. I know that.
People who produce Sesame Street.
Mm. But it's not for me.
I think we have a feeling, obviously, on the part of the panel, which I should think, looking at the audience, may well be shared by a very large number of them also. And it really, I think, is that people have forgotten how to do nothing intelligently. Now, here you have four Grecians who are obviously very skilled at this, because they're very energetic, they produce a great deal, and the real answer is that they can fill their time by thinking. And I think what they're suggesting really is that the danger of television is that it fills time and allows people not to think.
No?
Well, I also fill my time by reading.
True. But that's not thinking in a sense, that one is compelled to think.
But I never saw it.
Don't fall into that British habit of supposing that McLuhan is against the book.
Well, my dear, I'm sorry. What is people to
say.
I didn't say you were against it, but you thought the time of the book was over.
Obsolescence is the moment of superabundance.
No.
The book never had it so good.
No.
But it is no longer constitutive of the culture that we live in. The book will abound and superabound in the next few decades because it is obsolete. Obsolescence is not extinction, it is superabundance.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't think it's obsolete.
Well, I know, you know.
But I personally make my living out of the book.
Great.
I make my living. I teach it. I revere it. I study it. I study your work, sir.
No,
as a matter of fact, I have to give a lecture on you tomorrow morning.
Oh, my God! Well, all right. This will all be the best for me.
Theater and the Visual Arts. A discussion between Marshall McLuhan and W.H. Auden. Also present on the panel were Buckminster Fuller, Jack McGowran, and the moderator, Professor Norman Jeffers. The discussion was recorded at the annual University of Toronto Irish Studies Seminar and was edited for broadcast by Judy Stockman.